Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 27th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we had the Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Looks like he's in a underground bunker. He's holding his hands up, looking up at the roof, and you could see cracks in it, small rocks and debris falling in around him. On the wall behind him, you see all kinds of supplies, water and drinks and food. There's an Iranian map. On the other wall, there's a chair, microphone, a couple of Iranian flags, and a gold curtain behind it where you see his pronouncements on TV sometime. The headline is Iran on the Brink. Will the U.S. join Israel's all-out war? And, of course, since this magazine was published, there is more news on that front, but we will start with that first main story. Trump demands Iran's surrender as he weighs strike. What happened? President Donald Trump signaled this week that the U.S. could join Israel's assault on Iranian nuclear and military sites, calling for the Islamic Republic's unconditional surrender and declaring that his patience was wearing thin. Administration insiders told media outlets that the president was impressed by Israel's initial surprise attack on its longtime regional foe, which involved more than 200 warplanes, a fleet of drones smuggled inside Iran, and commando forces on the ground. Dozens of targets were hit in the first wave of Operation Rising Lion, which killed some of the country's top nuclear experts and eviscerated the highest ranks of its military command. The head of Iran's elite Revolutionary Guard was among the dead. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he'd order the attack to counter an imminent nuclear threat, adding that Iran would have an atomic bomb in a very short time if it wasn't stopped. The assault significantly damaged Iran's uranium enrichment facility in Natanz, but left untouched the Fordo enrichment site, which is buried deep beneath a mountain and vulnerable only to U.S. bunker busters. Trump greenlit the Israeli offensive after growing frustrated with months of U.S.-Iran negotiations that had failed to persuade Tehran to give up nuclear ambitions. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon, he wrote on social media on the fourth day of the bombing. The next day, he wrote, we control the skies over Iran and know exactly where Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is hiding. After speaking with Trump about the Israeli campaign, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said he believes the president wants to finish the job at Fordo. Khamenei declared that his nation will never surrender and warned that any U.S. intervention would be met by irreparable damage. At least 24 Israelis were killed in retaliatory Iranian missile strikes on Tel Aviv and other Israeli targets. Israel's strikes on Iran killed at least 225 people. Trump, who faces a schism in his MAGA coalition over Iran, said his next move was uncertain. I may do it, I may not do it, he said, of U.S. intervention. I mean, nobody knows what I'm going to do. What the editorial said. Iran could have averted this onslaught by heeding Trump and agreeing to roll up its nuclear program, said the Wall Street Journal. But the regime, which has long vowed to destroy Israel and America, refused to do that because it wants a nuclear weapon more than it wants peace. Israel has done a favor for the world with its offensive. Now it's up to Trump to finish the job of eliminating Iran's nuclear threat. No, it isn't, said the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Iran is an ideological and geopolitical adversary of the U.S. and a threat to Israel, a key ally. But the U.S. strike on Iranian nuclear facilities would only further destabilize a region whose order already rests on a knife's edge and would possibly pull us into a wider war. And remember, Trump's own director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, told Congress only 3 months ago that U.S. intelligence believes Iran is not building a nuclear weapon. The president must stand down. What the columnist said. Israel's stunning attack followed 8 months of intensive clandestine preparations, said Barak Ravid and Dave Lawler in Axios. Even as Trump pursued a deal with Iran, Israel was gathering intelligence, positioning assets, and conducting drills for covert sabotage operations against missile and air defense sites. Hundreds of quadcopter drones were smuggled into Iran in suitcases and shipping containers, said Dov Lieber and Andrew Dowell in the Wall Street Journal. The drone attacks wiped out dozens of missiles on that first night and helped Israel quickly establish dominance in the air. This is the moment to topple the Iranian regime, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Its air defenses are crippled, its missile capacity is decimated, and proxy groups such as Hamas and Hezbollah are battered. Netanyahu denies regime change is his goal, but allows that it's a potential outcome, and it's one America should covet. Yes, we learned in Afghanistan and Iraq that regime change carries risk, but there's a cost to regime preservation as well, especially when that regime has waged a decades-long global campaign of chaos. U.S. and Israeli hawks have long claimed that Iranian government would fall apart if pushed, said Nicholas Grossman in MSNBC.com. But a surge of nationalism seems just as likely. If the regime survives, it could rebuild and resume its nuclear program. And if it falls, it may not be replaced by something better. The result could be a chaotic vacuum, just like the one that followed our overthrow of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Trump faces a fateful choice, said David E. Sanger and Jonathan Swan in the New York Times. If he obliges Israel and GOP hawks by bombing the Fordo nuclear facility, he'll be stepping into a potential quagmire and waging just the kind of war of intervention he has sworn he would avoid. If he doesn't, Israel may fail and leave Iran on a pathway to the bomb. For now, he's walking a line between persuasion and coercion, but soon he will have to decide whether this is Israel's war or America's. And we'll read the second main story today. Minnesota Democrat killed in political attack. What happened? Authorities this week arrested the man suspected in a shooting rampage targeting Minnesota state Democrats that killed two people and gravely wounded two more. The most severe attack in a growing wave of political violence. Vance Luther Bolter, 57, was captured after a days-long manhunt and faces federal charges of first-degree murder and attempted murder. In the indictment, prosecutors say he dressed as a police officer and went to the home of State Senator John Hoffman, shooting Hoffman 9 times and his wife, Yvette, who was shielding the couple's disabled daughter 8 times. Both survived. Then he briefly stopped at 2 other Democratic lawmakers' houses before reaching the home of State Representative Melissa Hortman, a former State House speaker, where he shot and killed her and her husband, Mark. Bolter's associates described him as a married father of 5, an abortion foe, and a devout Christian who had voted for Donald Trump in 2024. In the hours after the shootings, Elon Musk, Donald Trump Jr., and other right-wing figures falsely identified Bolter as a leftist, citing his prior appointment by Democratic Governor Tim Walz to a nonpartisan advisory board. And Senator Mike Lee, the Republican from Utah, made posts on X joking about the killings. Senator Tina Smith, Democrat from Minnesota, confronted Lee in person over those posts, saying he should think more about the hateful things he is putting out. Lawmakers across the U.S. have faced a rash of recent attacks and threats, with incidents in Texas, Georgia, Virginia, and Arizona currently under investigation. Some states have begun offering elected officials increased security. "I'm worried for my family," said Ohio State Senator Casey Weinstein. "I worry I'm putting them in harm's way by being in office." What the editorial said. "We still have much to learn about the suspect's motives," said the Minnesota Star Tribune. "But this much is certain. This was political violence. An assassination and an attempted assassination carried out with chilling premeditation and precision." Police say Bolter had a kill list of nearly 70 targets, most of them Democratic lawmakers and pro-choice public figures. The toll could have been worse, and lawmakers are understandably spooked. "This was an attack on all of us and on our system of self-government." That list included Senator Smith's name, said Newsday. And while her confrontation with her Republican colleague may depart from normal Senate decorum, it was as necessary as it was unusual. One of Lee's posts, made before Bolter's capture, jokingly referred to the assassination as "Nightmare on Waltz Street," implying the Minnesota governor was somehow responsible. That Lee so eagerly tried to identify the shooter as a political enemy and only deleted the post after days of criticism is reprehensible. Such partisan animus costs lives. What the columnist said. "Hortman, the slain legislator, was a true public servant," said E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. "As Speaker, the progressive lawmaker built diverse coalitions, paying careful attention to the broad range of views among her colleagues, so she could pass laws protecting abortion and trans rights and secure education funding. Now she has been felled by an assassin's bullet, and her frightened peers are desperately trying to scrub her home address from the internet and beef up home security." "America's luck has run out," said Brian Kloss in The Atlantic. "Our fraying society, torn apart by polarization and flooded with firearms, was ripe for combustion. Trump's incendiary rhetoric, calling his opponents human scum, suggesting some should be executed, lit the match." In 2022, a QAnon disciple who bought his election fraud lies attacked the husband of then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, while last week someone shot at the campaign headquarters of an Arizona Democratic candidate. "Trump himself has narrowly escaped assassination at least twice," said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal. "Proof that this murderous impulse exists on both sides. Right and left each paint the other as a bigger threat than the foreign enemies that seek our country's destruction. If you call your opponent a fascist, as the left does, or a fifth columnist for an invading enemy power, as do some on the right, why wouldn't people take command of their otherwise dire fate by eliminating them? Political leaders must stop demonizing opponents, and pundits must stop cosplaying civil war from behind their laptops. If they don't, the fire that's coming will consume us all." Controversy of the week, Trump making the military into a partisan militia. In the space of a few days last week, President Trump politicized the military, said the Washington Post in an editorial. And it wasn't just the parade. Yes, the procession of troops, tanks, and artillery that rattled through Washington in nominal celebration of the U.S. Army's 250th anniversary, but before a president who just happened to be celebrating his own 79th birthday, was a pointless show of muscle flexings. Americans could shrug off that sparsely attended pageant, which cost up to $45 million to stage, if not for the fact that it came just days after Trump sent 4,000 National Guardsmen and 700 Marines to help quell immigration protests in Los Angeles over the objections of California Governor Gavin Newsom. Presidents have deployed troops before on U.S. soil, but always as a regrettable last resort in times of grave civil unrest, not gleefully to put down mild disturbances arising from protest against their own policies. Worst of all was Trump's de facto MAGA rally at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. While vendors sold MAGA hats outside, Trump got a crowd of enlisted troops, pre-screened for political allegiance, to cheer him and boo his enemies, including Newsom and former President Joe Biden. The president's self-glorifying boorishness, like his authoritarian yearnings, is not exactly a secret at this point. But with these concrete steps to turn our politically neutral military into a partisan militia, Trump has crossed a pretty bright red line. It's hard to overstate the danger here, said Jeet here in The Nation. Those who downplay the threat of a Trump dictatorship like to point out that beyond the annoying goons of the Proud Boys, he lacks a mobilized mass movement like the brown shirts who backed Adolf Hitler. But who needs a paramilitary when you have an actual military? The founders saw this coming, said Ruth Marcus in The New Yorker. The means of defense against foreign danger, as James Madison put it, have been always the instruments of tyranny at home. Trump is no Madisonian scholar, but last week he put it beyond doubt that tyranny at home is what he's after. Trump will be Trump, said Mike Nelson in the Dispatch. He's been trying to blur the line between the military and politics since he first took office in 2017. But it's disturbing and new to see service members join in with that effort, as they did at Fort Bragg, where the crowd lapped up Trump's false claim that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Young soldiers will make mistakes, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic, but when they do, senior officers must speak up. The scenes at Fort Bragg were obscene, but most chilling in the aftermath is the silence of the generals. The footage from Fort Bragg is disturbing, said Max Boot in The Washington Post. But the Washington parade left the opposite impression. Trump doubtless wanted a menacing, goose-stepping parade a la Moscow or Pyongyang. What he got instead was a cheerful tribute to the Army's history, delivered by 6,000 troops, many of them women or minorities, who walked together, but not in lockstep, smiling and waving at the spectators. Trump is up against the fact that political neutrality has been a bedrock principle among the ranks for the past 2.5 centuries, said Zach Bocamp in Vox. The generals have been quiet, and the troops have so far followed Trump's orders. But the more aggressive he gets in trying to use the military for domestic repression, the more likely there is to be resistance, at least theoretically. And it's time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Manifest Destiny. After U.S. Army Secretary Dan Driscoll, speaking to Fox News about the military's ability to handle simultaneous deployments, claimed to have talked to an astronaut yesterday who's on the moon, who's a soldier. As of press time, neither NASA nor the Pentagon had confirmed an active U.S. military person on the moon. It was a good week for special interest after the Ghana Drunkards Association gave the West African nation's government 3 weeks to do something about the soaring price of alcohol, warning that a failure to act would result in mass protests by the group's claimed 16.6 million members. It's a good week for El Pindón Estrellado after pop star Neza booked to sing the Star Spangled Banner before a Los Angeles Dodgers game, performed the anthem in Spanish to protest ICE raids. Although the team expressly asked Nezha to sing in English, it said there were no hard feelings. It was a bad week for operational security after the X account Pentagon Pizza Report informed its followers that as of 6:59 p.m. Eastern Time, nearly all pizza establishments nearby the Pentagon have experienced a huge surge in activity. The post came an hour before the first news reports of Israel's attacks on Iran. It was a bad week for Lewis Hamilton after the seven-time Formula One world champ struck and killed a groundhog during the Canadian Grand Prix. Hamilton, a vegan and animal lover, sounded more upset about the devastating collision than his sixth-place finish, saying, "I just hope it didn't suffer." Finally, it was a bad week for background checks. After the New York Post reported that Sergio Gore, the White House aide tasked with vetting executive branch staff, has not been vetted for a security clearance. Gore, who says he's from Malta, has yet to submit a form listing his birthplace and past residences. It's a "the lady doth protest too much, methinks" type situation, said a source. Time for the briefing. The title this week is "The God in the Machine." An AI model with superhuman intelligence could soon become reality. Should we be worried? Who's trying to build super intelligent AI? Companies such as Google, OpenAI, Meta, and Anthropic have collectively dedicated more than $1 trillion to developing artificial general intelligence, or AGI. That's shorthand for a future technology that can do almost anything a human can. Drive, talk, learn, solve problems, create, and so on. For now, most AI models excel at one or two tasks, such as generating text and images, or solving mathematical equations. But the ability of these systems to take in and process data has expanded at lightning speed, with a number of parameters inside models, connections analogous to synapses in the brain, going from millions to billions to more than a trillion in a few years. Many industry experts believe it's only a matter of time before a system reaches AGI, or even artificial superintelligence, ASI, a form of AI that surpasses human intelligence in every way and can make its own decisions. Demis Hassabis, CEO of Google DeepMind, argues that the arrival of AGI will usher in an era of maximum human flourishing in which disease and poverty will be vanquished and space will be colonized. Other experts are less optimistic. Daniel Kokotajlow, a former OpenAI researcher who refused to sign a non-disparagement agreement when he resigned from the company in April, foresees something like a 70% chance that AI will catastrophically harm or even wipe out humanity. How close is AGI? We're not there yet, but the technology is advancing fast. Late last year, OpenAI's O3 model scored 87.5% on the ARC-AGI test, which measures fluid intelligence, the ability to solve logical problems and recognize patterns without prior knowledge or training. In March, University of California, San Diego researchers released a preprint study suggesting that two AI models, OpenAI's GPT-4.5 and Meta's Llama 3, had passed the Turing test, formulating answers that led human interrogators to believe the bots were human more than 50% of the time. And machine learning will only accelerate. A recent survey of 2,778 top AI researchers found that, on aggregate, they believe there's a 50% chance of a system outperforming humans in all tasks by 2047. Some think superintelligence will arrive far quicker. AI 2027, a detailed forecast co-authored by Coco Tajlo, predicts that within 2 years, a single AI system will be doing the work of 50,000 coders at 30 times their current speed. Would that be good for humanity? Economic productivity would skyrocket as supercapable AIs unleashed a flood of innovation. AI-optimized biomedical research could put us on track to eliminate most cancer and double lifespans, according to Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei. Autonomous self-aware vehicles could fill the roads and skies, and new materials could be developed that are lighter and stronger than anything devised by humans. And while artificial intelligence has a notoriously large carbon footprint, AI-specific data center servers used enough electricity last year to power more than 7.2 million homes. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman has confidently predicted that the technology will unlock nuclear fusion, providing plentiful, climate-friendly energy. Could this technology be dangerous? A super smart AI might be a civilizational risk in the wrong hands. A simple verbal or type command like, execute an untraceable cyber attack to crash the North American electric grid, could yield a response of such quality as to prove catastrophically effective, according to a recent State Department-funded report. That paper also warns of massively scaled disinformation campaigns in which personalized AI-generated video, audio, and text turn Americans against each other. AGI-powered drone swarms and robots could overwhelm military installations, and just as an AGI could be tasked with creating breakthrough medicines, it could also be used to craft lethal bioweapons. An artificial superintelligence trained on all publicly available text, including those written by Unabomber Ted Kaczynski and Adolf Hitler, might also independently conclude that humanity is not worth preserving. AI 2027 ends with a scenario where, in 2030, an AI network douses the Earth with a chemical spray. Most people are dead within hours, the co-authors write. The few survivors, e.g. preppers in bunkers, sailors on submarines, are mopped up by drones. Is that scenario likely? Some experts dismiss such forecasts as pure science fiction. AI 2027 reads like confessions from a psychiatric ward, said Brian Chow, head of the AI nonprofit Alliance for the Future, adding that AI innovation is getting harder, not easier. That's because there are limits to how much data can be fed into AI servers, how fast chips that power AI systems can be manufactured, and how much energy can be supplied to data processing centers. Current AI models also do not display human-like multifaceted intellectual agility or even a solid sense of the physical world we inhabit. Still, Altman and other tech leaders believe these are solvable issues. Where does that leave us? Facing an era of upheaval, if not necessarily apocalypse. Even without AGI, said Anthropic's Amodei, unemployment could surge 20% in the next 5 years. As AI swallows jobs in law, finance, coding, and consulting, many Silicon Valley execs believe the government will need to provide a universal basic income to avoid a spike in poverty and social unrest. And if ASI is achieved and the utopian dreams of the tech optimists come true, people will face the psychological challenge of finding purpose in a world where AI has made them obsolete as workers, creators, and decision makers. Relying on a superintelligence that can outreason you, outplan you, outnegotiate you, and do it all more creatively than you ever could, that will surely hit at the essence of what it means to be human, said computer scientist Louis Rosenberg. How could that not feel demoralizing? Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Gnomes threat to liberate Los Angeles. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem came to Los Angeles last week to issue an authoritarian threat, said George Skelton. Federal agents who'd been arresting scores of immigrant workers are not going away, Noem said. In fact, the Trump administration would liberate the city from its socialist elected leaders, Governor Gavin Newsom and Mayor Karen Bass. It was the sort of language used by dictators, but in America, the liberators are the voters who elected Newsom and Bass by large majorities. Democratic U.S. Senator Alex Padilla was in the audience at Noem's news conference and lost his cool. California's first Latino senator walked toward Noem, identified himself, and shouted out a question. And federal agents responded by dragging him out, forcing him to the ground, and handcuffing him. Padilla, the son of Mexican immigrants and an MIT graduate, shouldn't have shouted at Noem, but Noem's threat to occupy a city with soldiers indefinitely and oust its chosen leaders understandably upset him, as it should all Americans who believe in democracy. As Padilla said, if U.S. senators can now be roughed up on camera, imagine how this thuggish administration treats the nonviolent immigrants they're targeting. Russia's weak hand in Ukraine. Russia insists it's winning its war on Ukraine, but new data reveals it has little to show for its efforts, said Riley McCabe. Russia has been on the offensive since early last year, but its losses have been catastrophic. Russian casualties in Ukraine are nearing 1 million. Since January 2024, Moscow has lost roughly 1,200 armored fighting vehicles, 3,200 infantry fighting vehicles, and 1,900 tanks. All that for seizing fewer than 1,800 square miles of territory at a glacial pace similar to the trench warfare of World War I. Ukraine's ingenious military has saturated the battlefield with drones, which are taking a deadly toll on Russian soldiers, and have fortified their front lines with minefields, trenches, anti-armor obstacles, and artillery positions that shred assaults. The Kremlin's only path to victory is if the U.S. completely abandons Ukraine. Russia's Vladimir Putin is betting that political fatigue in Washington will deliver him what his military cannot, but he holds a far weaker hand than many in the West assume. To force him to negotiate, the U.S. would expand military assistance to Kyiv and impose new sanctions on Moscow. Russia can win only if Washington lets it. This column comes from Spain. Prepare to be tortured on the plane. It all started with olives, said Susana Cuadrado. In 1987, American Airlines CEO Robert Crandall saved $30,000 by removing olives from the salads served on his planes. That kicked off an industry-wide push to squeeze every nickel possible out of the proletarianized economy class. First, they took our peanuts, crackers, and newspapers. Next, they crammed us in with less space between seats in rows and in the seats. The headrest, and in some airlines, the bathroom, disappeared in the scramble for savings. Now, the European Transport Council has not only agreed to allow European airlines to charge for carry-on baggage, but also recommended lengthening the time a flight can be delayed before the passengers must be compensated. Today it's 3 hours. Soon it could be six. How far can airlines go in this race to the bottom? 8 years ago, industry shills at a Hamburg aviation fair proposed packing more passengers into the cabin by putting them nearly vertical, propped up on a little bicycle seat, their legs dangling almost straight down. That's right. Flying standing up, after all, you can fit a few more rows of passengers that way. Dismissed at the time, the Skyrider idea is now creating buzz again. Is the day coming when we will have to travel strapped into such a torture rack? Now that we've normalized the abuse of economy passengers, anything is possible. The last word, our feature article. Are the BRICS evil? The Nazis built an idyllic village close to Berlin for SS members and their families, said Sally McGrain in the New York Times. Current residents are still reckoning with its history. One morning in January, Susanne Bucher, a family doctor in Berlin, woke up worried. National elections were approaching, and President Donald Trump's most vocal advocate, Elon Musk, was publicly supporting Germany's far-right party, the Alternative for Germany, or AfD, whose leaders have spouted Nazi slogans and downplayed the Holocaust. Bucher sent a letter to her neighbors. Tomorrow is the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, she wrote, expressing her fear that fascism was again taking root in Germany. Over the next few weeks, about 40 neighbors got together, lighting candles in their front gardens as part of a nationwide chain of lights protest against hate and hanging pro-democracy signs in their windows. I think we have a special responsibility, Bucher, 62, said recently over a cup of tea, because we live on an estate that was built by perpetrators for perpetrators. Their quiet little neighborhood, Waldsiedlung, or forest estate, Krumlanke, is a sought-after place to live in the German capital. Named after an adjacent lake, its residents compare it to a fairy tale village. Little peaked roof cottages with wood shutters are built into a dense green forest, crisscrossed by mossy paths. Whole swaths are carless. Children play in the gardens while dogs run free on a sloping meadow. In the summer, a short walk in flip-flops and a bathing suit leads to the lake. But life here also means channeling Germany's brutal past. The neighborhood was built in the lead-up to World War II as an elite community for the SS, or Schutzstaffel, the elite guard of the Nazi Reich, whose responsibility included carrying out the Holocaust. The SS Kameradschaftssiedlung, or SS Camaraderie Estate, as it was initially known, was one of the few housing developments built by the Nazis in Berlin. During the war, the roughly 600 small apartments, row houses, duplexes, and single-family cottages housed SS members and their families, according to rank. The settlement was designed to embody the Nazi Blut und Boden, blood and soil ideology, which touted Aryans' quasi-mystical relationship with their ancestral land. War was in the blueprints. The cellars were designed to double as bomb shelters, and the tree cover was useful for thwarting airstrikes. As a commemorative sign in the village now acknowledges, the peaceful atmosphere that the settlement embedded in the landscape conveys to the unbiased observer today makes it difficult to recall its history. It is a history that is still being unearthed, much like the original tenants' pots, pans, and swastika-marked coins that residents or their dogs have dug up over the years, and evokes Germany's nearly century-long quest to both remember and forget. Hannah Arendt called it the banality of evil. Matthias Donath, a historian specializing in Berlin's Nazi architecture, wrote in an email, "Recently, Donath's research made headlines when he was able to draw a direct line from Waldseidlung, Krum Lake, Lanke, to Auschwitz, where former village resident Joaquin Caesar was the head of agricultural operations. The residents found ideal living conditions in Idyll," he said, "and at the same time, they planned monstrous crimes." How the residents here have reckoned with the past or not has followed larger cultural trajectories. For decades, it was swept under the rug. One method of survival in a destroyed and morally devastated Germany was repression, Donath said. As a result, some of the village's residents are unaware of its history until neighbors tell them. "Some people say, it's 80 years ago, it has nothing to do with me," said Suzanne Gunther, 67, a teacher of disabled children, who moved here with her family in 2000. "For me, it's the opposite. I want to know what happened here in my house. It's intimidating to hear about families drowning themselves in the Krum Lanke or hanging in the attic, but you can't move forward with silence." Not much is known about daily life on the SS estate, though it was certainly a place where quality of life was predicated on plunder. If you would go to the Forest Estate in 1943, how many women would you see wearing fur coats? Asked Christoph Kreutzmüller, a historian and the chair of Active Museum, Fascism and Resistance, a Berlin group organized in 1983 to mark the 50th anniversary of the Nazi seizure of power. "Probably they all had fur coats, and they all came from murdered Jews." Historians agree that as the Red Army approached, some families fled while others likely died by suicide. The SS estate was not a place to hide. Hanno Hochmuth, a historian with the Leibniz Center for Contemporary History Potsdam, said during a recent walk through the development, "The soldiers may well have come upon a peaceful estate. You don't see any bullet holes. Then open the doors to find dead bodies or floating in the Krum Lanke Lake." After the war, the abandoned homes were given a new purpose. Now located in Berlin's American sector, they were used as shelter, with preference given to victims of Nazi persecution, including resistance fighters and refugees. The family-friendly layouts, which had been designed to encourage couples to produce as many future Nazis as possible, quickly overflowed with the displaced. Street names were changed. Some of the older current residents arrived around this time. Gisela Michaelis still lives in the 900-square-foot row house she moved into when she was 5 years old in 1945, along with her mother, two older brothers, and two younger sisters, after the family fled the advancing Red Army in the east. Her father, who fought for the German Wehrmacht, never returned from the war. "There were endless children here," said Michaelis, 85, a retired accountant. She and her friends would roam the estate, illegally gathering kindling from the forest, testing their courage in the cellars, or pilfering apples and pears from the gardens of empty houses. It was a beautiful childhood. Some families of defeated SS operatives probably also returned. This was typical of post-war Germany, Hochmuth said. Persecutors, bystanders, and victims, all living door-to-door without too much struggle. There was a tendency to forget, to want to start over. Michael Joachim moved to the estate with his family in 1946 when he was three and remembers both a happy childhood and the stories his father would tell about the families who preceded them. That neighbor went into the Krummlanke with his whole family. That one hanged himself from the rafters in the attic. Joachim, 82, a retired school principal, recalled a quiet Jewish couple who lived in what is now Bucher's house. I can still see him in my mind's eye, gray-haired and stooped, he said. Only later did I think, what kind of fate must they have had? Joachim and his wife converted to Judaism in the 1990s, thanks to an affinity for Jewish life and culture that dates back to his childhood, when his father would listen to a weekly American Sector radio program dedicated to the subject. He later served as chair of the Representative Assembly of the Jewish Community of Berlin. When assembly members would visit his home, the location never raised any eyebrows. For me, it's a conquering of the past, he said. That a place that was created for Nazis has been totally taken over by other people. The first real research into Waldsiedlung Krummlanke was published in the 1980s, around the time a grassroots approach was reevaluating history, known as Dig Where You Stand, was gaining traction in West Germany. It included details of how the estate was funded. The SS did not want to pay for it, so a semi-public housing company called GAGFA built it for them. Raking leaves beneath her cherry tree, Ingrid Fielder, 86, said she knew nothing of the estate's history when she moved into her little duplex in 1985. At the time, she worked for the GAGFA Housing Company, which still owned and ran the estate. One sunny autumn day, she and her husband went for a bike ride around the lake, and they rested on a bench. Another couple asked if they knew where the SS estate was. Fielder had heard of it, but didn't know where it was. The next day at work, my colleague said, "Don't you know that you live there?" "That was news to me," she said. The discovery didn't change how she felt about her home. "I lived through the Hitler time," she said. Now she worries about the ascent of the far right. "If people keep voting this way, we're going to have it all again. I don't want that." In 1992, Berlin made the estate historically protected site as an example of Nazi-era housing development built in the Heimatschutzstil, or homeland protection style, of architecture. But reluctance to grapple with the past lingered. When historian Karen Grimm researched the estate in the 1990s, she did not find a single interview partner. In the 2000s, the estate was privatized, sold, divided up, and resold, and historical information, including old tenant contracts, was probably thrown out. Among current residents, Elmar Bossen and Caroline Fry know more about their home's past than most do. The woman who sold them the house in 2011 was a journalist. After they toured it, she pressed a book titled Medicine Without Humanity into their hands and told them that a Nazi doctor named Joachim Murgowski had lived in the house. Murgowski, chief of the Hygiene Institute of the Waffen-SS, was tried in Nuremberg and executed for his war crimes, which included putting poison on a bullet and shooting concentration camp prisoners in the thigh, and then documenting their efforts to gag themselves as they died. He also experimented on human subjects for a typhus vaccine. "When we heard that, we thought, can we do that? Can we move here?" said Fry, who used to run a music magazine. It was like, are the bricks evil? Sitting in their eat-in kitchen, a vinyl box set by a Berlin cult band and beet steaks prominently on display, Bossen, who was studying to become a human rights lawyer, and Fry, a school teacher, said that after much soul-searching, they decided to forge ahead. The building, they reasoned, couldn't be held responsible for the deeds of its first inhabitants. And maybe their liberal worldview was just what the place needed. The couple, both 55, have been happy here, as has their 9-year-old foster son, Juan. They were glad to join the new neighborhood's initiative's rejection of the AFD before the national elections, in which the party made historic gains. We hung signs from our windows to make it clear, in this estate, that we are against this. We find it horrifying, Fry said. We want to remember, because remembering this horrifying thing might help it not happen again. Still, while living in Waldsiedlung Krummlanke has a way of making the past feel present. We don't think about it every day, she said. Like many residents, the couple said the tangled legacy of this village as a peaceful, healthy place for families, created to enable a genocide, remains irreconcilable. The conflict has died into the fabric of modern life in Germany. I don't know if it's something Americans can understand, said Henning Mueller, 41, who lives here with his wife, Milena Fernando, 40, and their two young children. Here in Germany, we have this nice life, and at the same time, this dark history is part of your everyday. 4 years ago, when Fernando, who works in administration at the Jewish Museum Berlin, learned that her family could take over an acquaintance's lease on an airy 3-bedroom converted attic, she jumped at the chance. The family was glad to move out of their cramped 1-bedroom in the city, where prices were skyrocketing and apartments were scarce. Now their children are growing up not too dissimilarly from Gisela Michaelis or Mikhail Joaquin, or even from the first children who ever lived there. Families like us, with kids who learn to swim in the Krummlanke, Fernando said. It's a crazy thing to imagine that SS members lived a normal family life here, then went to work at concentration camps. It's hard to grasp. The story was first published in the New York Times. And I think we've just time for one of the talking points article. We'll do No Kings, a turning point for the resistance. The anti-Trump resistance finally has reawakened, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. Millions of disgusted Americans poured into the streets last week across 2,100 cities and towns under the No Kings banner to protest President Donald Trump's authoritarian administration. Even reliably conservative locales like Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and the village's retirement community in Florida saw thousands of demonstrators. With Trump sending in soldiers and Marines to occupy Los Angeles and staging a military parade in Washington, D.C. to honor himself, the weary resignation that followed his reelection is giving way to outrage. No Kings feels like a potential turning point. In fact, it may have been the biggest day of demonstrations in American history, said Will Neal in the Daily Beast. Data journalist G. Elliot Morris estimates 4 to 6 million people came out to show their opposition to Trump's toxic far-right policies. Overall, the number of protests and rallies against the Trump administration, 15,000 in total, has increased threefold since the same period in 2017. A mounting backlash against Trump is gathering momentum. Democrats may be angry, said Jonathan Turley in The Hill, but this absurd democracy is dying message has grown stale. It's the same platform they ran on last November and lost. In reality, Congress continues to perform its constitutional duties, and courts have both ruled in favor of and against the Trump administration. Democrats, meanwhile, have no message other than Trump hatred, which is why the party continues to poll terribly. The No Kings mantra is the Democrats' desperate attempt to implant their frustrated rage into the public psyche. The backlash to Trump is real, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com, and special election results prove it. Several days before No Kings Day, Democrat Amanda Clinton won an Oklahoma House seat in a 69-point landslide. The seat was in a Democratic district that Kamala Harris carried by 19 points, and the 50-point swing surpassed all expectations. Overall, Democrats have outperformed in 29 special elections this year, running 16.4 points ahead of the 2024 election results. Republicans are alarmed, which is why White House Communications Director Stephen Chung called the massive No Kings protest a complete and utter failure with minuscule attendance. When the Trump administration tells Americans not to believe their own eyes, you know that the prevailing political winds are changing. And a short piece from the Poll Watch. 35% of Americans say they approve of President Trump sending the National Guard and the Marines to subdue anti-ICE protests in Los Angeles, while 50% disapprove. And we'll close out today's show with a quote from Dorothy Parker, quoted in The Knowledge, who says, "Of course I talk to myself. I like a good speaker, and I appreciate an intelligent audience." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.